Okay, so this is, you have the basically the contents of the first six chapters. So how Manu is laid out is the first chapter then is the introduction to the work. So that establishes actually the connection of the work with the Lord. And that to do that, then you have to start from the Lord, the creation, then come down to the actual subject matter itself. That's the principle how it functions. So then coming down like that, then that establishes the subject matter itself and where it actually technically connects into the Lord's creation, the Lord's plan. Hare Krishna. So then the last chapter then concludes the work and shows how one can get yourself out of the material world, right? So the one shows how the living entities get in, how they can connect to the Lord, and then the last chapter shows how they can get out. So then the 10 chapters in the middle, then you can basically divide into two parts. The first 5 will be ashram dharma. The last part, 5, will be varna dharma. Then in the ashram dharma, they'll go through brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. So that all those then are followed by the dvijas. But it's all based on the Brahminical standards, like that. In the Vedic culture, Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, they all follow the same standard. And devotees, because they're automatically by ashram, basically, they're Brahmins. Therefore, then they follow, no matter even if their occupation is not Brahminical. Does that make some sense? So there's an overlap here. Because the Vedic system is meant to create those who know God and go back to Godhead. So that means the purpose of the Vedic culture is to create Vaishnavas. So Vaishnava is one who knows the Lord. And so one who knows Brahman means you understand that there is transcendence. So that's the lowest platform of the Vaishnava understanding or principle. So then that basically falls through into the mundane. So then that's the dvijas and the vipras. So they are initiated into the Vedic rites and they have the position of knowing all the different Vedic knowledge in that. So they're very knowledgeable in all that. But until they become realized, they don't actually become devotees. Because you can have so much Vedic knowledge and not realize what it's for, like we see Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. He had great knowledge. He was the greatest scholar of his day in India. You know, it's not just that he's, you know, one of our boys, so therefore he becomes prominent. He was the leading scholar in India at the time. There was no one greater than him. So, because Bhattacharya means, Bhatta means one who is like doing the puja, one who does the worship, one is, you know, very well situated. Bhattacharya means one who is acharya for the Bhattas. Like that. So that's considered, you know, like we had Rangaraj Bhatta and what was his name? They're the Bhatta family, Gopal Bhatta, Raghunath Bhatta. So they're all Brahmin families. But Bhattacharya means one who initiates those who do the deity worship. Like that. It means you get Upanayana, then they get a special initiation into the right to do temple worship. So the ones that do that, then they are the Bhattacharyas. Like that. And then of Bhattacharyas, then he is, you know, the greatest scholar. So he knows all the Vedic literatures, but he's not a devotee. So that's the point. They're respected as Brahmins, they're very elevated, but when they become devotees, then they've actually understood the Vedic culture, what it's for. So that's the principle. So therefore, the first 4 chapters are applicable to all devotees. Anyone who's taken up devotional service, then it's applicable. You know, some aspects may be a little more practical, some less, but the principles are always there. Like cleanliness is always there. what degree you take your cleanliness, that's another thing. But cleanliness must always be there. So there's no one who can't be clean, right? No one who can't be pure. No one who can't be respectful. No one who can't like these. So that's common. So those first four, the five chapters, are then for everyone. Then of the last, the second, you know, group of five that deal with the Varna Dharma, the first three basically deal with Kshatriya Dharma, because that's also very complex. The Brahminical ashram is the Varna Dharma for a Brahmin. So his ashram Dharma and the Varna Dharma are actually the same. Does that make sense? It's the same. There's no difference in it. In describing his ashram Dharma, then Varna Dharma is automatically included, because he's studying and teaching the scriptures, living by begging. So that's what your brahmacharis, they beg. And the grihasthas, they beg. The brahmachari studies, so for him to do his ashram dharma of study means someone has to be teaching. Right? That's the ashram dharma of the kshatriyas and vaishyas, that they do sacrifice. But how will they do those sacrifices? The brahmins do it. They do that for them. They serve as priests. So then that's their varna dharma. Right? Their varna dharma is ashram dharma for the others. Does that make sense? So their ashram and varna, there's no difference. So sometimes devotees will say Prabhupada didn't establish varna ashram. Means they didn't go into it deep enough. Because what he had running was varna ashram, but for the Brahminical class. Then he decided, okay, we have to expand this. Devotees aren't able to only just function in temple life, preaching, distributing books, doing these kind of things. So then he started the farm communities, these kind of things. Then you can expand and have the other varnas manifest. But the ashram still remains the same. Like that. So generally we would see that Prabhupada would take these duties of varna ashram on their purest state, which is actually the most elevated. So generally one would think it's the most difficult. It is only on the platform of ego, you know, or purity. But as far as technical, it's not. Technical is when you're down. Like the Dvija, when he's first initiated, is not very technical. Then when he knows all the knowledge and he applies it, then it gets very technical. Then when he comes to the Vaishnava platform, then again it simplifies. Because then the one doesn't know anything, principle or detail. The Brahman knows detail, but he may not be clear on what's actually the principle. Vaishnava knows the principle, so he only applies the detail that needs to be done to accomplish the principle. Does that make sense? It means the principle has to be established. How much detail has to be applied to accomplish that, that's how much is used, not more. So that's what makes the uniqueness of the Vaishnava culture. So then, the Brahminical is already included, Varna Dharma is already included in the Ashram Dharma. So the five chapters of the Brahminical Varna Dharma, Ashram Dharma is also the Varna Dharma, and is the Ashram Dharma for the others. Then the Kshatriya, then the three chapters are there. So the first chapter will be how he establishes himself in the kingdom, how he sets up his kingdom, like that. Basically how he sets it up, how he runs his time, how he does everything. Then the next chapter is, the next two chapters are on law, how he deals with civil, criminal, and domestic law, like that. So there's 18 titles of law, and so then in these 18 titles, then he must then deal with that. That's what he has to see to, because by that then his people are protected. That's in the last, you don't get it in here. It's the rest of the table of contents, I think, takes it up to something like 45 pages or something. the last half is huge. So then, yeah. Then the next is then for all the ashrams, you know, like that, all the varnas, what they can do in times of distress. If they can't properly follow, there's not availability of performing their natural occupational duties. What are alternatives for them? Both within keeping to their own duties, you know, within their varna, or dropping out of their varna to lower varnas. What they can do. Then the 11th then deals with if you've done something improper in the either the varna or ashram dharma, then what is the rectification for that? Right. And then the last is that the ultimate rectification is going back to Godhead. That's the ultimate, you know, correction of criminal mentality, right? So just being in the material world means we're criminals, you know. But, you know, at least it's mentioned, at least be a nice criminal while you're here. You know? And then if you can understand it's not worth being here, then the devotees and the endeavor and they get out of here. Okay, so is that understood? That's the layout of the book. So just very clear. And in the very end, the last, I'd say last two pages or something, then it deals with the Vaishya and Shudra Dharma. Like that. Because economics is not something that you explain within the religious principles. That's just practical economics. Religious principles means what is the actual inherent nature of something and how to deal with it so you, you know, that you, I mean, how you said, everything has its nature, so we have our inherent nature. But everything else around us also has, both animate and inanimate. So how we, maintaining our natural inherent nature, how we would interact with another inherent nature. Because it changes. Just like, let's say, you want to mix salt with sabzi. Okay, so then that's, you know, you put a little bit of salt to flavor, and you may put a little squeeze of lemon for flavor. Right? So the volume is actually the vegetables. But now let us say we're going to make lemon pickle. Right? The proportions greatly change. Right? Then it's all lemons, and, you know, it's half lemons, half salt. So it greatly changes. So that then creates that. If you only put in a pinch of salt in the lemons, then they'll rot. Right? So the nature of lemons is to rot. The nature of salt is to preserve. So if they're mixed in the proper quantity, then you get a preserved lemon. Right? But salt is not great to eat on its own. But lemon is. Right? So that's the whole idea is the dharma means understanding what is the actual nature and sticking to that. When you go outside of that, then it's not proper. Therefore, it's called irreligious. So it's not a matter of, oh, we don't care for rules. The devotees don't do anything irreligious, so they always act according to the inherent nature. Now, Vaishnavas may sometimes use a higher nature for a lower, so they may act on the platform of the soul. But in some situations, they're acting purely. Sometimes it's the soul mixed with the subtle body, or sometimes the subtle body with the gross body. Right? But they always have to be following religion. If they're not, then they've missed the point. Because the soul has an inherent relationship with the Lord, so does the mind, intelligence, ego, and the body, and the senses. Because they all belong to God. Right? So just as much as the soul belongs to the Lord and has an inherent nature that they have to perform, then the intelligence, mind, ego, senses, the body, the gross elements around it, they also have they're from the Lord and they have their inherent nature that they perform in relationship to the Lord. So just because it's our body, then doesn't mean we can do it with what we like. Because actually it's not our body, it's God's body. It's His mind, it's His intelligence, it's His ego. So the idea of independence, I do with it as I like, that doesn't actually exist. But because the living entity is not, tuned into that, therefore then they are quite happy to, they're quite happy to act as if it's theirs. It's within your quota, it's within your jurisdiction, then in your desires can function within that realm. And so if those desires are favorable to the Lord, it moves that way. If it's unfavorable to the Lord, it doesn't move that way. You know, does that make some sense?
Mm-hmm.
So basically religion is just understanding how does something work. The rules only ensure that you, is just a medium through which to, that you understand that. Right? A Brahmin by nature, the Brahminical quality by nature, then it's pure, respectful, knowledgeable, you know, these kind of qualities. So then, to maintain that, or to engage that, then there's activities that are favorable for that. Right? To sit down and study books is favorable for gaining knowledge, or for teaching. Right? To not study is not. To be pure, you know, or clean, then gives rise to, you know, purity. Right? Does that make sense? So there's an inherent nature that's brahminical, therefore all these other things go along with it. Does that make some sense? So that's what is religion. So it's not just ritual. Generally we think religion means ritual. No, ritual is just the natural way something would work. Right? Nowadays they speculate and make up their own ritual. But real religion comes from God, because He's made the thing, it works that way. You know, like religion of a dog. You know, they are territorial, at the same time as they're loyal. Right? Those they like, then they're pleasant with, and they try to be as helpful as possible. Those that they don't like, then they're as unpleasant as possible. And the, those who they are loyal towards, if you're unpleasant toward, if anybody outside is deals badly with them, then they get the same bad treatment. You know, whatever they would consider for themselves, they consider for who they're loyal to. That's the inherent nature of a dog. Right? But at the same time, as we see that that's packaged in, you know, not necessarily so wonderful, you know, arrangement. You know, they're dirty, they're gross, they're unsophisticated. So therefore, then, because of that, and the nature of humans, which is supposed to be more clean and more sophisticated, they can work together and interact, but the dog stays outside and the human stays inside. You understand? Because the dog's not clean, so you only go deal with the dog if you don't mind, you know, getting dirty. Does that make some sense? But that's the nature of the dog. Therefore, because that's the nature, therefore you put them out, they do guard work, they, you know, they do these kind of things, they roam in the fields, they help in this way. Because that's their nature. Right? Dogs, except for some wild species, dogs by nature interact with human beings. They always live around human beings. Because they live off of the remnants of human beings. You know, wolves, others like that, they don't. But you see, other dogs, they always just hang around where people are and, you know, eat what they have left over. And if possible, then they attach themselves to those human beings and then get taken care of. Like that. That makes no sense. So, and we have to see that nature is, everything has its nature. You know? The floor, its redness, that's there. That redness is there, but there's things that you can do. Now, if you put lemon on that floor, it will remove that redness. Right? So since the floor's inherent nature is to be red, then to put lemon on that floor would be irreligious. You understand? It's against the religion of the floor. Does that make some sense? You know, and it's smooth.
Is that the dharma when you say religion?
Yeah, religion, dharma, varnashram dharma. These are all interchangeable. Like that. You see Prabhupada uses it like that. Generally, the tendency is to think religion means the actual ritual that happens in the temple. You know, like an artik, or offering your obeisances, or chanting a mantra, or a yajna. That's religion. You know, and then you have varnashram, which is a social system. You know, and for most, they just look at it from the economics. They look at varna, not ashram. And like that, and then everything else, that's just the real world. You know? But the actual thing is that everything is working on Dharma. It's just a matter of whether you scientifically understand it or not. That's all. All in the West, they're constantly trying to figure out why does it work this way. So they're doing scientific things. And they come up with some observations that kind of have show a pattern in the nature of the living entity. So they think, yes, we've figured this out. We're very intelligent. So this is where knowledge comes from. The point that's being missed is God made the creation. So it works the way God says. So you can sit there and observe it. That's nice. But it's easier to gain the knowledge directly from the authorized sources. Then in your observations, you'll come up with much better and deeper understandings. But sometimes devotees will take the knowledge of the material world from the materialists rather than take it from the Shastra. You know, just like Prabhupada says, that men and women are different. The way they think, everything is different. You know, like this. But then some devotees don't like it. But when the scientists come up with things and they do this and they come out with a book, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, devotees will accept that lock, stock, and barrel. You know, they'll just read it once and it's gospel. But it's the same thing. We can explain exactly the same thing from our philosophy. Just, it's not seen, it's not carried across. You know, it's just not carried across. So what happens is devotees don't apply it. They're not using their intelligence to actually understand what is religion. They can't function without religion. A conditioned soul cannot function without religion. It's foolish to think. They'll say, oh, we don't follow all these rules. But you go into their house, you'll find very clear rules of religion established. You know, you can't go into their bathroom and leave their sink and counter a mess. And, you know, you can't squirt shaving cream on the mirror. You can't make a mess, you know, around the toilet. Leave the tap running. You know, rip the toilet paper and leave half-shredded pieces on it. They would say this is against the rules of the house. This is uncultured. Who said? Who established those rules? That's religion. Toilet paper has little, you know, how you say, perforated lines on it. You're supposed to rip it on the perforated lines. You know, taps are there. They're open or closed. They're not supposed to be half open. Right? Mirrors are for reflecting images. If you get, you know, shaving cream and soap all over them, then they don't reflect. Right? You know, does that make some sense? So all it is it's just the popular, whatever popular is, you know, the society itself in the popular common society deems as you know, proper, then that's what's religion. So that's the thing, is we see that the acharyas, they take religion beyond whatever, you know, the non-Vedic living entity, trained living entity, thinks religion is. And even within the Vedic, sometimes they become clouded by it. That's why you don't go. You don't go and, you know, rip up plants. It's against the religion. You know, they're growing out of the ground. You pull on them, and he pulls them out of the ground, and they can't grow. Right? And they have their right to live, so therefore, you know, unless there's some higher purpose that you're pulling them out of the ground for, then it's sinful. Right? The potato grows nicely in the ground, it'll just grow in the ground and make more potatoes and just keep, you know, doing its potato thing. Right? So you can only take it out of the ground if you're going to offer it to the Lord. Otherwise, to take it out of the ground is sinful. You know? Does that make some sense? So that's the whole thing of what. So they therefore it turns into morality. It turns into civil. What do you call it? Civil sense. You know, these kind of other kind of things that are all pranamoy. It's simply that. Huh?
Yeah. Mara, so with this inherent nature, then if you talk to someone about it, where is the root of it? It must be coming from Krishna.
Yeah.
So we must be then talking automatically about God.
Yeah, but you can always, you just talk, first of all, is you just talk about certain principles. You show how everything there goes back to principles. And because those principles are universal, then you can speak to anybody about it.
But in the new, often with the hippie mentality, you find that they'll put forward arguments that I mean, who said that mirror is for reflecting, or who said, I mean, it's like,
So, the utility of the inherent nature. Yeah, but then what is their right to doubt it? You know, just because they said it's for playing basketball with or something, or then it's just, you ask anyone and they'll say a mirror reflects, and because it's made out of glass, then it has that element also, that a glass has its religion. So if you crack it, if you hit it with something, it'll break. Mm. So that's the thing, is you can make up your own thing, but the point is the hippie didn't make the mirror. There's a manufacturer who's making it, and there's people who are buying it. And you'll find, interestingly enough, that all the manufacturers and all the people who are buying it for the purpose of reflection. Mm. So hippie can say whatever he likes, but on what authority is he making the stand that he can come up with a different opinion? He first has to prove that he has the right to say that. And if he says everybody has the right to say whatever they like, then you can either challenge that, either, you know, directly, or give an example. Oh, okay, so then we can say that you're, you know, this, that, and your wife is, you know, this, that, and, you know, and all, it's like that. And he'll say, no, that's unculture. Who said? You just said that we could say whatever we like. Therefore, there's an inconsistency in your perception. But no one will like it if you say bad things about them or their wife. So why is that? Because there's an eternal principle that's work here. Why love and peace? Why, who said peace? You know, they rip the screaming, you know, carrots out of the ground and, you know, and munch them up alive. And, you know, I mean, you could do anything, you know, with the... So what are they going to live off of, you know? They all breathe air, but in the air there's so many millions of living entities that die every time they breathe. So, I mean, they're only being maintained by violence. So it's just a matter of the degree of violence and whether that violence is carried out according to authority, authorization, or if you're just doing yourself. So that's the point, is they want to have this thing where they don't want to be controlled in the mind, and they want to just be free and do whatever they want. So all they're just big kids. Spoiled, you know, peaceful, spoiled kids.
So the base of it, they want to know.
They just want to be able to manipulate the material energy every way they like, because that's the thing. They take their drugs, they mix this one with that one, they try it this way, that way, standing on their head, you know, inside, outside, in a tree, you know, in the water, and you know, like that. That's the whole thing, is how to basically enjoy to the greatest degree possible without any restriction, but at the same time not causing undue grief to anyone else, like that, you know, like that. So like that. But even the principles of why you would use the senses, why the senses, why not something else, you know. So everything still works according to the thing. You want to see something, it has to be in front of you where you can see it with your eyes. You know, touch it, you have to touch it. You know, it's they can't go outside of what God's created. That's the point, is you can't leave that. It's already there. It's already, now it's just a matter of what you do with it. You deal with it in the way you like, or you deal with the way that God says it should be done. And within that, you have lots of options. You know, like Prabhupada says, milk, grain, sugar, ghee, you know, spices. You can combine them in so many different ways and make all kinds of things. Just the rule is that it should be offered to the Lord. You know, so within that you have so much variety you can do. But still, there's some restriction. Otherwise, there's always restriction. You should be unrestricted. But that's a restriction, that you should be unrestricted. You're saying, if I want to be restricted, I can't be. So you're restricting my restriction. You know what I'm saying? So it's the same thing. So that's why there's no difference between any of the materialists. It's just basically what level of consciousness, what they've chosen to enjoy themselves with. That's all. It's It's nothing different, nothing special. Does this make sense? So in other words, the whole idea is to broaden the outward view of what is religion. That all forms of religion of all life forms in the universe and anything that you will interact with, then that's worked into the Varnashram system. Right? So it's not a separate thing. It's all within it. Like that, it has its place. In other words, everything has to fold back somewhere. You know, and then from that, then it goes back into the Lord.
So it's seeing everything for its nature and then how to apply it in the...
Yes. Yeah.
Lord service and...
Yeah, like you take, let's say you take, you know, the fine arts. So the basic principle is aesthetics. That's the one common thing. So then music has its certain form of aesthetics, you know, the visual arts have their sort of form of aesthetics. So then everything will always come back to those principles, no matter what it is. It has to. Otherwise, how do you compare it? So that's the whole idea is that you have to have a common platform of standards by which all living entities can function. Then there can be community. That's the whole thing. If there's that same common standard, then everybody can judge it from that. There may be some disagreements on that, but you still, even in disagreeing, you have a platform from which you can function from in those disagreements. You know, that's the principle. So you have to establish some common set of values, and everything else has to connect onto that at some point. You know, it's like each one you can take and expand out into an ocean. So you take, you know, one ashram and so much aspect of that brahmachari study, then in study there's 14 books you can study, and then you take one of those books and then that has so many, you know, subdivisions to it. You take one subdivision, then it has, like that, you can go on and on and on. So everything can connect back. So the Varnashram system is that system of religion which all other sub-religions can connect to. Like that. And then Varnashram, to actually be a dynamic, has to be connected to the Lord. Then it actually works. Otherwise, then how do you apply whatever you're doing to every situation that you're dealing in? Right? Because otherwise, okay, you know how to deal in the temple, but as soon as a devotee walks out the door, he doesn't know how to behave. Then he starts talking about the real world. You know, the devotees are all nice, idealistic, this, that. But point is, the real world still functions the way God made it. You know, you ever have a businessman, he goes out and buys an item for 100 rupees and sells it for 10? Right? You know, and then you go into the shop and it says, the tag on it says 10 rupees, and you say, no, no, I must give you 20. Right? No, so economics has been created by God.
Right. Prabhupada mentioned that even in the Western culture it naturally forms that you have your priests and teachers and administrators just naturally out of the mess it will form.
It just, but it's just not scientific. Mm. So therefore they step over the lines and create trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, you have, you know, those who present themselves as intellectuals, you know, then they step over the lines of the kings, or the kings step over the lines of the intellectuals. Mm. You know, they all each try to get each other. You know, like that. You know, it's like Marx comes up with some kind of thing, and then Lenin takes that up, and then he steps over the line, and then Stalin walks in, and then, you know, wipes out everybody else. You know, like that. So there's no more intellectuals or business persons. You know, and though they say everybody is equal, then still there's the proletariat. That's who run the thing. They're still going around in their black limousines, like that. So what was the difference before? The Tsar goes around in his limousine, but they go around, and there's somehow or another that's noble while the Tsar wasn't. You know. So still, it's like everyone. What is it? Everyone according to their nature. Everyone according to their ability or their need. Right. So who's to decide what their nature and need is? Right? So therefore you have to have an administration. And what if one person decides his need is to take the other guy's property? then there has to be someone who's going to work out that no, no, that's not your need. So they have to be educated, or they have to be disciplined. And how are they all going to eat? I mean, someone has to know what's going on. You know, potatoes don't just, you can't stick them in the ground anytime you like and harvest them anytime you like. So these are problems. So he is speculating. So he's going out of the realm of what is his, he can think, he can observe, he can try to apply, he can see patterns, he can do all these different things. Because he's doing it without God, therefore he's missed the point. Right? I don't see, we don't hear of Marx going out there and working in the factory. Right? He's an intellectual. Why he's not in the factory? Why he's not in the factory? He's not practicing his own. You know what I'm saying? It's very nice, but the point is, because it's not connected to God, therefore it's unscientific.
Then it automatically comes to the Varnashram, because his excuse will be that I'm doing it for the people. And that's the duty of the king, isn't it?
Yeah.
That he does it for the people.
Yeah. So like that. So the whole thing is it must be consistent. And so the only thing that's always consistent is God. You know, because material desires are always changing and this and that. So there must be something consistent that as people's natures change, I mean not natures, but their mentalities change, or they change bodies and like this, and that there's a common pattern that they can always connect back to. Like that. So that's what's important. Therefore, Dharma Shastra. On the material platform, Pancharatra on the regulated spiritual platform, and Bhagavat on the transcendental, unconditioned transcendental platform. So Pancharatra is conditioned transcendental platform, and Bhagavat's unconditioned. And then where you have conditioned mundane platform, that's Varnashram. So the three, because they're all connected to each other. From the Bhagavat, then means you have the Bhagavat, then you have those who are in the material world. So they can either be trying to get out or they're staying in. So those who are trying to get out, if they're happy with just dealing with, you know, preaching and deity worship and like that, then it works nice. But if they have to, you know, maintain a family and stuff outside of that, then you bring in Varnashram. And the family life itself, Pancharatra doesn't care. Cover that. You know, it tells you how to do archman, artik, you know, install a pot, worship the deity, make an offering. Like that, dress the deities. It doesn't tell you how to talk to your wife. That's Varnashram. So then the three, because Varnashram has come from God, then it works. Then it functions. Does that make some sense? So that's the whole thing. If one understands how the three are, that from Bhagavat comes the Pancharatra, and from that then expands into the Vedic, then it works very nicely. So depending upon your attachment and conditioning, you have to come into the material world that far to deal with it. Right? If you have attachment for food, then you have to come to the platform of food to deal with it. You can't just deal with it in your mind. You have to actually come to interacting with foodstuffs. But now how you'll interact? Any way you like, or in the way God says? So if you do any way you like, then you get entangled. You do it according to what God says, then you free yourself, you become liberated. Does that make sense? So this is how the thing functions. So if one understands this, how it moves in and out, then it works very, very easily. If one doesn't understand, then one just gets caught up and one can't figure out. But still, you'll see, even those who reject Varnashram, they become very, many times, either totally into gross sense gratification or very dogmatic about moralism and justice and all pranamoy stuff. They reject manamoy, which is a higher platform of consciousness, but accept the next one down, pranamoy. And they're always fighting for people's rights on the anamoy platform. You know, that's the thing. And they never talk about liberation. Because renunciation means no sense gratification. So it's opposed. Therefore, you'll see they'll fight the most against these things. So it's not favorable for devotional service. Devotees should understand everything has its place. You know, just like it was up to kids, all they do is eat sweets all day or something, you know. So that's not good for the health. It has to have a balanced diet. So just because people want it doesn't mean it's good for them. So therefore somebody who's more mature restricts that and tries to train them in higher tastes, higher understanding, higher values. So you train the child how to eat properly. Then they develop that taste for a wide variety of food and like that. So that's the thing, is because where's the standard? Who said that you have to be moral in this way, or please the people, or, you know, be respectful, or, you know, not, you know, whatever it is, it has to be, why? Even when we take something that everyone, don't steal, why? You know, why stealing is bad? Right? Universally everybody accepts. Why does everyone universally? That means that somebody universal must have established it. Right? So the only, if otherwise, why is it inherent? No one likes to have their stuff stolen because there's attachment. This is mine. I identify with it. Then it's taken from me. You know, then it throws off my whole identity, my whole process, my whole goal. Everything gets thrown off. So it doesn't good. So it's established. Everyone has their quota. And here's the methods how you get your quota. Here's the methods how you keep your quota. Then it starts to function. So it's not arbitrary. So that's the whole idea, is just because one's become a devotee, that doesn't mean that now he is free to do as he likes. Devotee means he follows the laws of God. So one can't claim to be a devotee and at the same time claim to go against the Lord's rules. But those rules have a purpose. That's the whole thing. The rules have a purpose. Okay. So any more any other questions on this point?
And so, because you explain this, how one can see, you know, all this, in from different angles, you know, how common sense, we can use this term, right? Common sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's common sense.
Common sense represents intellect of a person. So that means,
to some degree, it is. But see, common sense, you have the intelligence. Now, common sense means two things. One is that you can identify a practical way to get something done. And the second is that you've accepted to do it that way. So there's two different functions. Does that make some sense?
Mm-hmm.
That you have identified that here is a very easy, straightforward, practical way to do something. That's intelligence, because you can differentiate between an impractical and a practical way of doing things. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's intelligence. But the intelligence isn't what makes the decision. The mind makes the decision. So that the mind has a value to do something practical. So therefore, of options that I could do, this is the most practical, so therefore the mind accepts the practicalness. You understand? Then you can say someone is practical. You know, he's using his intelligence in that way. You know, but many people see what's practical and don't do it. They know that this is the best thing, but they can't do to attachment because they have a different value system. So the whole thing of the Vedic culture is to create a common God conscious value system. Then everybody can apply that value system according to their time, place, and circumstances. And then you come up with, even though you have people that are so different, they can all function together. Except for discussing philosophy, you can take an impersonalist, You can take a Karmakandi, you know, you can take a young man, an old man, you know, any of the varnas, any of the ashrams who are following the Vedic culture, put them all together in one room and they can interact with each other very nicely. They could eat prasad together, they could use the bathroom, they could sleep, they could do anything and it would be common. But, so you have a basic, but what is their goal in doing it? Ultimate values is they're following these rules to go back to Godhead. These ones are following to go to the Brahman. These are following to go to the heavenly planets. These are following it to enjoy here. You know what I'm saying? But otherwise, there's a common platform by which they can decide what is socially acceptable, what's not. What is a practical way or do it or not. Right? But then in certain things, then one person would say practical is this because it's detachment. Detachment gets you out of the material world. Therefore, I'll take that one. But someone else is that no, attachment is that not they want that because that's what there is. So at some point you'll run into problems. But there's philosophy, and then they have a common system of discussion. Right? The Vedas also have logic and discussion, so they have codes for that, so everybody can discuss it. You know, there's methods of how the intelligence works. You understand? Like you're saying, it's practical, but that takes two things to do, right? The intelligence and the mind. So you have to be able to tell the difference between those two. That's the religion. The mind, of the religion of the mind, is to accept and reject. The religion of the intelligence is to discriminate. So in discrimination, it can do two things. It identifies the various items, so it shows the difference between them so that you can separate and say this item is different from that item. Right? So it shows options. At the same time, it also puts them together. And so it can understand, so this item and that item have this commonality. You know, just like this blanket and the floor. They both have red in it, right? Same time as over there, the floor has black, so that's also common. You could look at it, they're both flat. You know, like that. You could look at it that they're both on the walls and the ceiling and the floor, they're both on, you know, on the lower part of the room. You know? So many ways you could find similarity, you could find differences. That's really smooth, this is rough. That's cold, this is warm. That's solid, this is flexible. That's immovable, this is movable. So intelligence can discern, but that's what it does. That's all it does. That's why if somebody's too intellectual, then those who are practical aren't impressed because they've thought of 10 million ways you could do it. But, you know, the point is you have to choose one of those 10 million ways and do something. If you don't do anything, what's the use? What's the use of intelligence if it doesn't result in an activity? Existence is not enough. Right? God is existence, but He expands for rasa. He exists and He is happy. Right? So in existence, there is no abhideya. Right? They just exist. So He exists and He's satisfied in that existence. So your sambandha and your prayojana are there. He expands to expand that. So He expands the sambandha. The existence becomes manifested as the unlimited living entities. That expands His happiness and that is done through interaction, the abhideya. Does that make some sense? So, just so you can intellectualize and think up so many things, so what? You've thought of so many varieties of existence, but you have to do something. So until you choose it. Right? And if somebody just, the first thing they see, they just grab it, that's also not considered intelligence. Maybe practical, but a form of practicality, but it's not ultimately practical because intelligence has to be there. You have to use your intelligence to see what is going on. What are your options? Right? Otherwise, then you may mistakenly choose a lower option when you have a higher option available. Does that make some sense?
In this last phrase,
you know, you may decide you're hungry right now, and so you're going to walk all the way over to the front gate and buy a pack of Chanachur, right? So that's something right now, but then if we look at the bigger picture, in half an hour, then there's going to be, you know, full Peshad. You know what I'm saying? So you could say you could do that, and then he got the pack of Chanachur. It's not very satisfying. It filled his stomach. He's not hungry. And then half an hour later, when it's time for lunch, he can't eat lunch. So then some might say it wasn't very intelligent, because it was practical. It got his hunger removed. But if you look at a bigger picture, it may not have been the ideal, because it removed his hunger, but it wasn't good for his stomach. You know? Like that. It wasn't actually satisfying. While sitting down and eating a freshly cooked full meal in the association of the devotees, then will be both spiritually and materially better for him. Like that. Does that make sense? So that's the point, is that kids are, you know, identified by their just going by the mind at this moment. And adults, generally, it's like they have more, they apply more intelligence. You know, it's a general statement. Does that make some sense? Yeah. In other words, these laws aren't just rules. We're not now going in and looking at a whole bunch of rules and, okay, what we do, what we don't do. We're looking, trying to see what is the inherent nature of something. Therefore, that's why this rule is there. So how does that rule maintain that inherent nature, enhance it? And then there's the thing is, why deal in that nature? Why would you choose grihastha life as opposed to vanaprastha or sannyas or brahmachari? Why would you choose brahmacharya over kshatriya, vaishya, shudra? Right? So that has to be answered. And then within that, then one is going into grihastha life for certain purposes, certain needs. So therefore, if he's going in for a certain stability, certain emotional interaction, certain, you know, certain independence that's there, therefore, then those things have to be maintained. Right? If he's going to grihastha life and not getting emotional exchange out of it, what was the meaning of his going into it? Right? He accepts the vocational duties of one of the varnas, but doesn't make any economics out of it, then what's the meaning? What's the purpose? Right? He accepts an ashram, but he doesn't advance, then what's the use? You know, so there must be a purpose to it. Right? So therefore, what's going to create emotion? Sensuality doesn't create emotion. Sense control creates emotion. Right? Because as soon as the senses are engaged, then the emotional experience is not there. Right? Does that make sense? But the emotion can include the senses, but the senses don't necessarily include the emotion. And here, when we say emotion, we're talking here, there's also a point that needs to be pointed out, is the difference in levels of emotion. When we're referring to emotion here, we're meaning the actual, you know, pure emotion that's within the rasa. Right? So rasa means that it's the five main rasas. That's the real emotion. Then that's supported by seven secondary rasas. Secondary rasas don't make the first rasa. Means there some are compatible, some are not. You know, like that. So, in that, just like, let us say, fear, not fear, or let's say horror, you know, is not our chivalry, you know, anger, these kind of things. They may not be nice in, let's say, most of your rasas. But in Shanta Rasa, it's not unfavorable. You can appreciate somebody just because they're just so, you know, heavy and nasty and everything like that. They can be an enemy, but you appreciate them that here is a serious enemy. But you couldn't have that same quality in a relationship with a friend. Does that make sense? So, but those themselves don't make, just because you have chivalry doesn't necessarily mean that you have any of the rasas. You just have chivalry. Just because you have laughter doesn't mean that it's anything. It could go anywhere. Right? Master and servant can laugh. Right? People who just appreciate can laugh. Friends can laugh. You know, parents and their children can laugh. Husband and wife can laugh. You know what I'm saying? So it's not actually the main rasa. But nowadays, most people don't even know what the rasa is. They get together with friends and just go and laugh. Right? But friendship is actually that is someone you can depend upon. Someone you consider an equal. Someone you consider to be like yourself. Right? So then, if all they do is these other things, then that principle is not maintained. So when you really need help, then they don't care. They're not actually friends. So you didn't actually taste friendship raw. So then what happens is then you lose faith. You don't trust people. So when you don't trust, means you're not tasting the rasa. You're getting something secondary. And then when that secondary is not there, then there's no rasa at all. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point, is that these secondary are there, but then you have ones that are even lower than that. Your anger, your lust, anger, greed, envy, attachment. You know, illusion, madness, all these things. Those are lower than that. So we're not talking those when we talk emotion. We're talking the emotion of the sense of duty between different individuals. That based on that, then they taste something. Right? Like a very strong example is they're still making World War II movies. Right? There's only a handful of guys still left. And even though it was, you know, more than 50 years ago, right? They still sit them down and they still say, yeah, you know, we were there, D-Day, and, you know, you know, they dropped us in, it was really tough, you know, a lot of our boys were lost. And, you know, they're going on, just go on, it's 60 years later. But that experience was so strong, they're still talking about that. You know? They'll talk about that probably more than other things in their own family. Because that was real camaraderie. They were real friends. Does that make sense? So that's the whole point. They tasted rasa there. And when they come out of there, they don't. So therefore they always remember that, go back to reunions, watch movies on it, you know, watch serials on it, and when I was a kid, you know, that was how many years? I was 20 years after the war, and it's like there's at least two or three World War II serials always on. You know, something, you know, there's one that's in North African theater, there's one that's in the European theater, and then there's one that's in the Japanese theater. Right? So it's those three shows going on all at the same, you know, so you can watch any of them. And then there's always your special movies, your this, your that. So it's just constantly, it's a theme that's always going on. Because it was just so strong. The intensity of camaraderie that was there was more intense than they probably feel with their own wife. Because there it had to be real, otherwise you die, you know. And if they're trained and they know something, then they'll get the same taste in the other rasas, with their children, with their wife, with their friends, with their other kids. They'll get it. But if they don't know, there it has to be. So they're forced. Otherwise, you don't hear him talking about other things. You know? Like that. So you can, does that make some sense? So when we're talking emotion here, we mean that emotion of that interaction there. You know, the husband is doing his best for the wife's doing for the husband. That kind of stuff. You know, then whatever else is there, that's secondary to that. That's a different, that's subsidiary to it. It's not the main. Right? The guy brings in money, okay, but why is he bringing money? Out of care for the wife. Right? You know, so that's all secondary things. You know, so there's a basic principle that they're founded on. So that is why someone goes into the Grihastha Ashram. Right? If you check, basically everyone goes in for the same purposes. Because that's the inherent, like, seed of the ashram. Everything else expands out of there. But someone remains a brahmachari for the same basic reasons. Everything expands from there. Someone takes up business for the same purposes, and then everything expands from there. You want to create economics. What you sell, how you sell it, there's unlimited variety. But everybody's selling it to make money. And what are they going to do with the money? Then they're going to, you know, develop or maintain something. Yeah. So that's pretty fundamental. You know? And you could say, oh, that's so fun, that's so easy. You know, we want to know more. We want to go into something higher. Says, no, if you don't understand that, you don't understand business. If you don't make a profit, you're not doing business. You know? No, but that's so simple. You know, I want to know what's, that is it. Now the detail how to get that done, then that's a great science. Does that make some sense? So that also has to be, you're just pointing that out, so you know when we mention emotion, that's what we're meaning. We're meaning the emotion, inherent emotions that come up from performance of religious duties. So on a different level. Because those can always be appreciated. Happiness, distress, you know, attachment, and those things, they come and go. But that, the other, those things in the inherent within the rasas, you know, due to, based on the Varnashram system, those are always maintained.
Staibhava.
Yeah, that's it. It's the Staibhava. So the whole point is the Staibhava is there. That Staibhava is reflected into the material world. And so then in the material world, we call it Varnashram. Because it's not based on inherent nature. Yam kama krodha sahaja pranayada bhiti vatsalya moha guru gaura sevi bhavaihi. According to their bhava, they manifest a particular form, and that with that form go the activities. Right? The cowherd girls don't take the cows out, the cowherd boys do. You know? So, because they have that way that they want to serve Krishna, that sthaibhav, therefore it manifests their form. And then in that, then you have all these other aspects of bhava. And then you have the sanchari bhavas, which are all the slightly little things that are always coming, going, and moving, and all that. So that creates the taste within the main bhava. Like that. And then from that main bhava, then you have the ecstasies that come up. But there's something that creates that. You know, like that is what creates that mood, and what's the situations in which it is established. You know, so how rasa works. So everything comes down to rasa. But so there it's spontaneous, coming from the soul. But in the material world, the soul has decided he's God. Right here, that God's already God, and the living entities they want to serve in a particular way. So how do you make something function? When the living entity that's supposed to take a form according to their love for God decides they are God. So what form do they have? There is no form. Because they're not God. So then what kind of God they want to be, then they get that form. Okay, they want to be husband God, or they want to be wife God, or they want to be daughter dog God, or dog God, or worm God, or you know, like that. Because all of it they're trying to control and enjoy. So now he's controlling and enjoying as a worm. Yeah, it's worm and stool, you know. It's just, yeah, I got this pile of stool. I'm the top worm in this pile of stool. You know? Like that. So this is the scene that's going on. So you reflect it into the material world, and because everybody's changing parts, moving around in it, therefore you have to set up as a bunch of rules. Just so in that, it means the purpose is you should understand it as an inherent nature, and your inherent nature actually goes back to your servant of God, and in that your servant of God, you have an arasa. Like that, but on the maintained material platform, you still have a conditioned nature, and by that, you're still functioning within the material sphere. So then, you take, okay, that you're in the material sphere as a grihastha, so then that means, okay, and then you're the man, so therefore then, to make that work, these are your duties. Right? And they're not arbitrary. You look in the spiritual realm, Nanda Baba does all these duties, all the other husbands do those duties. That's the way Krishna set it up. And the women, they have their duties. Okay, Gwaska's mother just showed it, it's like that. The children have their duties, that's the way that it works there. The cows have their duties, the grass, the tree, everybody has, and it's all based on what the original living entities are doing in pure rasa with Krishna. So that's where it reflects from. So that's the point, is that there it's real, here it's not. So when the devotees say the real world, but it's actually not real. It's a reflection of the real. But the point is why it says that if the real means the material energy functions the way she functions, it doesn't matter what you think, it's going to work that way. So that's what's actually the real about the real, you know, the material world. That's the reality. You're going to, there's birth, death, old age, and disease. That's the way it is. You know? And so that those aspects come in. So to be able to see that is where it's come from. Then it makes sense. So that's why it's not an imposition. It's just natural. It's the natural state of engaging conditioned nature. It's not the natural state of the soul, because the natural state of the soul is not in the reflection, but is in the original. That's why it's only worthwhile dealing with the reflection if you're doing it to get to the original. Like that. But that's how it functions. You know? But it's not that by being in the conjugal ras here, then you're going to get into conjugal ras. So that doesn't work. It's because you have an attachment for conjugal ras. Therefore, then, you engage that in the Lord's service the way he says it's supposed to be engaged. You'll purify yourself of this conjugal rasa. Then you'll give it up. Then you can get into the spiritual world. Like that. So it's taking a thorn out with a thorn. Like that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. But that's the whole point. So it comes down, therefore, to rasa. Technically, these are the rules of rasa. Because if you do like this, then rasa will work. If you don't do like this, rasa doesn't work. So that's the thing, is you have religion and you have sub-religion. So morality, justice, economics, you know, all these sentiments of extended sense gratification, these are all sub-religious. They're not actually religion. They're sub-religious. Though, as sub-religious, they have their particular religion, the way they work. But that, it only becomes uplifting as religion, you know, as a means, when it's connected to the actual religious process. And that only has meaning if it's connected to the world. You know? So, artha and kama have their inherent nature, but it's based on religious principles. It means, in the Artha Shastra by Chanakya, so it's all based on what's in Manu Samhita. Many times he quotes straight from Manusamhita, then explains it all in how to apply it for economic gain. But he starts there, because otherwise it doesn't have... Where do you get it from? How do you know how economics work? Economics are already established by God. You know, the principle that you need economics is already established by God. Otherwise, why is it everybody feels, even the simplest tribals, they have some form of economics? You know, you're rich because you have more cows, or I think there's one tribe that they have more clay pots. So they don't do anything with the clay pots, they just have more. So every time they have to shift their tent, you know, the guy's, you know, his wife is very careful about her, 20, 30 clay pots, because that's her wealth. They've all accepted that who has the most clay pots is the most wealthy. What they use them for, I have no idea. You know, maybe they use one or two to keep a few things, and they just got them, because everybody's just accepted. And one may say, well, that's pretty absurd. But it's a clay pot, at least you can put some water in it, or, you know, put some grains. What about a piece of colored paper? You know? It itself absolutely useless. You know, it's even too stiff to use as toilet paper to blow your nose with. You know, it's got faces all over, so you couldn't write on it. You know, so it itself has absolutely no use. You know, no use. But everybody accepts that this useless piece of paper is very valuable. So that's it. But that need for economics is created by God. That's why it's so inherent, from the sophisticated to the unsophisticated, like that. It's to the cultured, uncultured, it's all accepted. It's a common principle. So dharma, artha, kama, moksha, those are created by God. But the actual thing is devotion to God, bhakti. That's the real. And these others, they're there in that form, in bhakti. But in the material world, they're reflected, and then people look at those and forget the bhakti. They don't see the connection. So that's in manas what the first and the last chapters are for, is that you see that connection. You know, it's basically how it's come into the material world in the first chapter, and how to get out of the material world in the 12th chapter. That's the system. So here in these will go into it more. So the best thing is that on here is that these things are read, studied, you know, so that when we discuss we can go through them more quickly and efficiently, if there's already some familiarity with it.
You mean to go through this?
Yeah. Means this, so then on the next, today is what? Today is Friday. So on Monday, then we can discuss more seriously what is going on here. You know? But what today's discussion was is always try to see it in relation to that. What is the inherent, what's the nature going on? What's the connection to the Lord? You know, how is that working? Where does it come? What's its reflection from the spiritual world? What's its form? Why does it work that way? Right? Because the point is, if that's understood, then one is more inspired to use it that way. Of course, if one just has good sentiment and faith, then that's nice. But still, one should intellectually know why it works. That's what Prabhupada Krishna is saying in the Gita. Perform your duties for me with knowledge and devotion. Like that. So is that the knowledge is important, because then you'll actually operate it better. Because otherwise sentiment can sometimes be changed. But if it's based on knowledge, then generally it can't be changed. Because knowledge turns into value, not sentiment.
What to say if in some cases, there is a lack of knowledge, but there is some, one just knows that there is some principles he has to follow. For example, like we have many rites and rituals and devotional service in our daily activity, and we just know that, let's say out there, all these principles, we just have to do it, but some of them we just take because of our faith, because we consider them as a part of our process, without understanding. I know, like Srila Prabhupada, he gave his, you know, the best example of cow dung, which is antiseptic. So, but you know, so my point is that sometimes we don't have such knowledge.
No, some knowledge is there.
Like maybe we don't know why we have to take sweets in the end of meal.
No, but those are metaphysical aspects.
Mm-hmm.
That's metaphysics of it, or just downright, you know, how you say mundane, you know, gross.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something to do with the body. But what we're meaning here is that you have to know how it connects. You're doing worship to the Lord. Why would you worship the Lord? What the meaning of the lamp is and the water, and that's another thing. That's the metaphysics. Why should you worship God? Right? That has to be able to be answered. Why would you use these systems? Right? In other words, you're going beyond that. Okay, well, what is the incense for? No. Why would you be even using this system at all of Artik for worshiping the Lord? You know, what would be, why that? What's the stand? Why is that used? You know, first of all, is you have to understand who is God, who are you? You know, if that's not established, how do you establish that your interaction is worship? Right? Unless you know what the sambandha is and what the prayojana, how do you establish that worship is the abhideya? Then within worship, then why would you do an artik? What is the authorization of that? Right? So Prabhupada says, that's in the scriptures, that's from the Pancharatra. Why the Pancharatra? Why Pancharatra? Why not Tantra? Why not Vaikanas? Why not meditation? You know? Why not Yajna? Because it's established by the Acharyas that in this age, then Pancharatra becomes the system for supporting the Sankirtan mission. Right? You know what I'm saying? This is what you need to know. The other metaphysical, that's nice, but if you only know that and don't know this, then you don't know the connection. Therefore, devotees change. You know, one day they're in ISKCON, one day they're outside ISKCON, one day they're in the Brahma, you know, I mean the Gaudiya Sampradaya, the next day they're in the Shris and the Nimbarkas or the Madhvas. Because they don't know. They just like their ritual. They like wearing a lungi. I don't like wearing a dhoti. You know, in the South they wear lungi, so I like it better. Or their tilak's more cool than our tilak. You know? Like that. You know, something. Or they just like the bhav that's there, so then they go there. But, you know, it's a, why? It's just, in other words, there's there, it's nice, they've come, they've taken up devotional service, but they don't actually understand what's the whole, why it's there. So therefore they move around, they change. Otherwise if they knew, why would they change? You know, I've seen devotees, you know, they always say, you know, certain names of God, I say, why do you say that? He says, it doesn't matter. You know, they're going, Narayan, Narayan. He says, why do you say that? He says, you know, what does it matter? Narayan, Krishna, it doesn't matter. As long as you get out of here, then. He says, yeah, then if all it is you want to get out of here, then the closest place out of here is Vaikuntha. So that's where you're going to go. You're only going to go to other places other than Vaikuntha if you specifically have a deity you worship. Right? It means either you're worshipping Ram or you're worshipping Dwarka Krishna, Mathura Krishna, or Vrindavan Krishna. Otherwise, you'll only go to Vaikuntha. You know, because that's the general field. You worship God. You know, so one should have, one has to have some basic understanding. You know, then he has faith in that basic understanding. Then he may not know the technical points, the metaphysical points of it. That's another thing. That's secondary. That's not the principal point. You know, all it is that the Pancharatra authorizes this because this is what Krishna likes. So Krishna likes the artik, so we want to please Krishna, so we offer the artik. And in that, then Prabhupada says the most essential thing in deity worship is punctuality and cleanliness. Therefore, the artik is offered on time and everything is clean. So if we know that, then we're doing fine. Even we don't understand exactly why, you know, the water is in the conch shell or it's in the panchavati or why the spoon looks like that. Or, you know what I'm saying? Those aren't the real, that's not the real knowledge. Like that. Because that would be, okay, you know, that's there because the conch is pure. But why is conch pure? You know, where does that come from? You know what I'm saying? So you can keep taking it back. So that's, you know, an ocean. How much, you know, you come across, how much you know, that's nice. But you actually have to know is the basis why you're doing it. And that comes from that top down. That's called descendant. If it's just, no, this is artik, why this, you know, then it's ascending. So that's the difference between, that's basically the difference between between sakam and nishkam. You know, how do you say, that principle of sakam or nishkam. Sakam is a start from what I have and engage that in the Lord's service. The other is I start from the Lord's service and then to serve the Lord, I see what facilities I have. So externally it'll look the same, but the mood is different. Does that make sense? So that's the whole point, is that you have to see. Because you're knowing, you know, what the different articles of the art thing are for technically. What is that knowledge so you can please Krishna, so you know it more, so you understand better how it connects? Or is it simply your own interest? If it's your own interest, then it's jigyasu. If it's actually to please the Lord, then it's jnani. So one has to, since it's an intellectual point, then you have to discern between different classes of intellectualizing. For yourself, or for God, ascending and descending. So when it's descending, it means you're starting with God first, and then coming down. Ascending means you start here and go up. Does that make sense? So that's why the Vedic literatures always start with God and then come down. It's descending knowledge. It's not ascending.
What about those situations, for example, when a pure devotee is preaching to some fallen souls, for example, like Prachinabhati, in the case of Prachinabhati Shat Maharaj? So like Narada Muni, he spoke in a different way, indirectly.
But it's based on what? He knows what a king does. Otherwise, how does he have all these gates? In the kingdom, in the palace, that there are certain gates. The king goes through certain gates only. The common people come through other gates. The Brahmins come through certain gates. What a king does when he goes out that gate. Means all that's in the analogy. What's that based on? It's based on Varnashram. He's not just making that up. Everything he's saying there is perfectly in line with the Varnashram system. That's the point, is Varnashram is consistent with the philosophy. Any branch of Vedic knowledge is consistent with the philosophy. Therefore, each one is interchangeable. You can take this and describe philosophy. As you go through this, you'll see that you're not unfamiliar with this. That's the point. That's why we did the outline. Is there maybe one or two little, you know, little points here, little facts and figures that come up that are maybe new or interesting, but they're not something that's out of the realm that you haven't already heard of. You know what I'm saying? Like that. And not only that, you'll see it's what is Dharma Shastra, we would just call philosophy. But philosophy that's applied in the social structure, that is Dharma Shastra. The philosophy applied according to the planetary systems. That's astronomy. And how those planetary systems affect you, that's astrology. You know, how that philosophy functions within your body, that's Ayurveda. Right? How it affects your living, that's the Sthapanaveda. You understand? So you're just dealing with all you're dealing with is Krishna. And when you see Krishna, then apply it into the material world, that's then the Vedic knowledge, the other branches. Because Krishna doesn't deal directly with it, he indirectly deals with it. Therefore, this knowledge, just even though it's coming from him, it is him, but because it's touching the other, then it takes on a quality that could be used either way. Right? Shiva's in between. So that means it's in that tattva. It could either be used for Krishna or not. Use it for Krishna, it gets you out of here. You don't use it, it keeps you. So now, within this, then we'll see there's the invocation, like that. Then Lord Brahma is speaking, right? Because here Manu means Brahma. You know, in this point. As it goes, then it can mean. Because Manu is either the Supreme Lord, because he is the one who gives the rules to mankind. It can mean Brahma, because he's received from Krishna, and then he gives them to the sages and all that, and is handed down. Or it means Swayambhuva Manu, because then he hears it from him, and he actually gives it to us. Like that. So here, Manu can mean any of those. So sometimes you hear them interchanged. The sages will talk about Manu said this, and they're talking about Brahma. But Brahma is talking about Vishnu like that. And the sages then also talk about Swayambhuva. So therefore, though this part is spoken by Brahma, and the rest is spoken by Brihaspati, what he's heard from Brahma, but still if you say Manu Samhita means the laws of Manu given by Swayambhuva Manu, means he's the one that's going to take these and give them to you. But the origin of the laws that Swayambhuva Manu is going to give is Brahma, who got them from Krishna. Does that make sense? So, because it's the same principle, you know, and it goes back, you know. Krishna's expanded into Balaram, into Mahanarayan, into Karana Daksha Vishnu, Kira Daksha Vishnu, Garbha Daksha Vishnu, Kira Daksha Vishnu, then so many avatars. Does that make sense? And then Manu is one of them. So that principle goes all the way through. So one has to get used to sometimes this interchangeability of these things. So Brahma's narration, we see, is the first. So he talks about creation. So this is the discourse one, is the creation and the origin of the sacred law. Right? Because unless there's a creation, you can't have the sacred law. Right? Only after creation can you get a sacred law. Right? It's one of the parts of creation. So since we're trying to get to the sacred law, we have to describe creation. So then Brahma, he does the creation here. And in it you see then there's the primary creation, Sarga. And then at the bottom of this first page here, you know, where it says 29, like that. Then, or 1A2, then the secondary creation. That's his creation. Right? And then, after that, then Bhrigu takes up describing. Then he brings it down to the Manus. Manos, then you have to know times and the ages, because if you don't know time, how do you do time, place, and circumstance? If you don't know the ages, how do you know what applies in what age and what doesn't? Right? So to apply the law, you have to have that. You have to have the manus, who are the ones who establish it. You have to have time, because that's, you have to be able to know how to apply it. And then you have to have qualities of the ages. Then, once that's all in place, then he gives, we see on the third page here, the origin of the sacred law. So this is where it comes in. So God has given these duties. And then, after all that, then in the last point, then the 25 topics of the sacred law are actually established. Right? I mean, it's not here, because this is the we have to remember, this is the table of contents for the actual book we're going to study. Right? Like that. Then in Discourse 2, then we see that there's a set, why would you follow? Right? And where is it coming from? Where's the law coming from? So, why would you even follow the law, and where is that law coming from? Right, so once those are established, then we start with Ashram Dharma in Topic 2. Right, so then we have the rule of the sacraments. Means that's the sacraments up to marriage. And that counting marriage here, because it's a big thing, because that changes the ashram. But in the Brahmacharya Ashram, then up through Upanayanam, Chudakarna actually, then the second Chudakarna, that you'll see on the third, or Keshanta, it's also known as. It's done. You know? Then it starts the Brahmacharya Ashram. Right? Because before that is simply how the Brahmacharya has been initiated, and then what are all the conditions on just that he's in that ashram. The rituals that go with it. But what is actual, what he does, the essence of the ashram, then that starts here with Topic 3. What he has to do as a student, right? Then how instruction goes on, how he subdues the sentence, the Gayatri, suspension of knowledge. Study is not so important for us; it's a Veda consideration. Protection of knowledge, how he's gaining knowledge, but who can be discussed with, right? Then we see in the middle of this. Because we see on the next page at the bottom, Topic 3 continues. But one of the things, if he's going to be instructed and all that, he has to be instructed by a teacher. He only became a brahmachari by being initiated by the teacher. Right? So now he has to have respect towards the superiors. So that being such a major thing, and who is the acharya, and what are things that go connected with that, you know, then it gets stuck in there. Then it goes back with the ordinances. You know? This will happen again also in the eighth chapter, where you're dealing with how to run the court. The 18 topics of the, I mean, 18, how do you say, the legal suits that can be brought up as in the court. But in that, then dealing with witnesses is such an important thing that it becomes its own topic that gets stuck right in the middle. So then they're dealing with one of the topics, you know, in other words, how to run the court, then that gets stuck in the middle as its own. So sometimes there's something so prominent it becomes its own topic. So it's not that it's strange, you know, that shouldn't be there. It's just the way it works. You know, because it's so prominent, it's just like, you know, you want to describe A, but within A you have B, and because B is so important, therefore it becomes its own study, and then you can actually go back to A. Once you know basic principles of A, then you can actually start to work it. But to work it, you have to know B. So B will be described, then you'll go back to operating A. Like that. And then once you finish with A there, then you go to C, because B was already included technically in A. Like that. Then the duties of the brahmachari, like that. And then how he would acquire knowledge in times of distress, means he can't find a proper teacher like this. Then naistika brahmacharya, if he doesn't want to graduate, he wants to just remain as a brahmachari his whole life. And then discourse 3 is the grihastha ashram. So then topic 5, he graduates. Topic 6, it's what is marriage. What's proper, what's not proper. Like what families you could marry into, not what are the girls you look for or not. Then the marriage rites. the marriage rites, what they are, then topic 8 is that once they're married, then the grihastha has these duties, 5 great sacrifices. Like some of these things, this is also a previous somehow or another one of the glories of Microsoft Word is you cannot, there's some, you know, trick you have to do to get it to print the table of contents. If you print the whole document, it'll print it, but if you only want to print the table of contents, then it goes weird on you. So it's a difficulty. So we have more detailed table of contents, but you know, until we get the nerds to work it out, you know, then you know, some of the details you won't see here. Doesn't matter, because we're going to go to the work itself, so it's not as... But then you have the 5 great sacrifices. Prabhupada always talks about the debts that we owe, you know, to the demigods, to the sages, to mankind, to the forefathers, and to the ghosts.
Yeah. You owe something to the ghosts?
Huh?
We owe the ghosts?
Yeah, because they were like Vastu. Your building is sitting on Vastu. And he's a ghost.
Okay.
You know? In other words, just all those beings that are in the antariksha. So maybe ghosts, yakshas, rakshasas, paisachas. They have duties that they do. The universal affairs. So then... there's a duty you owe them. So there's different ways these are all taken care of. Right? And so then it goes through all those like that. And that takes through the rest of the discourse because that's just like fundamental. Then discourse 4. Then we have the modes of how they maintain themselves. Then the duty